Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, May 28, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, our telephone is on the fiscal state of the states and whether bankruptcy is an option. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear opening remarks from our first speaker and then some discussion between our two speakers with some questions from our second speaker. So first we'll hear from Professor David A. Skeel. He is the S. Samuel Arsht Professor of Corporate Law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. He's going to give us opening remarks of about 6 to 10 minutes, and then we'll hear from Professor Sanford V. Levinson. He's the W. St. John Garwood and W. St. John Garwood, Jr. Centennial Chair at the University of Texas School of Law. He's also the author of a book, Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. That book is available on Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble and all the regular outlets for such publications, so I'd encourage you to check that out. As I said, we're going to get some opening remarks first from Professor Skeel. With that, Professor, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. So I am, in my opening remarks, going to focus in particular on Detroit and also in particular on pensions and the pension dimension of the crisis, since that seems to me to be the biggest part of the crisis. But if folks during the Q&A portion or Sandy in our interaction want to talk about other dimensions of states' financial problems, such as state bond debt and things of that sort, we'd be happy to talk about that as well. So what I'd like to do is just talk really briefly about the extent of the pension problem, and then from there do three quick things. One, address the question whether pensions can be restructured. Detroit is certainly suggesting yes at this point, and I think that's the correct answer. Second, I'll talk a little bit about the arguments that they cannot be restructured, the arguments against restructuring pensions and bankruptcy. And then finally, I want to make an argument that the ability to restructure them is in fact a good thing, that there's some significant benefit. So the extent of the problem. Most people are familiar generally with the fiscal mess that many cities and states are in and the pension part of that. Just to throw out a couple of numbers, Detroit's pensions are roughly $3.5 billion underfunded. Chicago's pensions, not counting the teachers' pensions, are roughly $19.5 billion underfunded. If you throw in the teachers, it's about $30 billion underfunded. Illinois reports almost $100 billion of underfunding. Using more realistic numbers, it's probably $200 billion underfunded. Across the country, a wide range of estimates as to the underfunding, but the high estimates are over $3 trillion. So obviously a very, very serious problem, and in a number of cities and states, one that it's hard to see past. So that's what, in a sense, I'll be talking about. First thing I'd like to do, as I said, is address the question whether pensions can be restructured in bankruptcy. My short answer to that is yes, they can be restructured, but the restructuring is limited to the amount of the underfunding. So that to the extent that Detroit or another city or state has set aside funds for the pensions, those funds are protected. To the extent the funds have not been set aside, the pension obligations can be restructured. So if there were promised pensions of $1,000 and $600 has been set aside for those pensions, as long as the $600 has been segregated in some way from the city's other funds, that's fully protected, and it's only the $400 difference that that can be restructured. It's a little bit like a security interest or collateral, collateralizing a loan, but more specifically, the way I would characterize it is the funds are effectively held in trust for the pension beneficiaries, and Detroit, if we're talking about Detroit, and Detroit's other creditors, creditors besides the pension beneficiaries, simply have no interest in those funds. So answer to the question, can pensions be restructured? My answer is yes. It seems to me that they can be, but that restructuring is limited to the unfunded portion of the pensions, which in Detroit's case is roughly $3.5 billion. Second issue is, what are the arguments against restructuring pensions in bankruptcy? I'll talk really briefly about what I see as the three biggest arguments against restructuring pensions. Two of them apply to all pensions. One of them applies more specifically in the Detroit and Michigan case. So one argument that pensions can't be restructured in bankruptcy is that the Michigan state constitution has a constitutional amendment, a constitutional provision that specifically says accrued pension benefits shall not be diminished or impaired. And so Detroit's pension beneficiaries have taken the position. This means that even in bankruptcy, those benefits cannot be touched. There's a Michigan constitutional provision that precludes restructuring the pensions in any way. I don't think this provision will prevent a restructuring. And the Detroit bankruptcy judge, in his Detroit eligibility decision in December, reached the same conclusion. It's probably going to come up again when there is a trial on Detroit's proposed restructuring plan. A couple reasons why I don't think this prevents restructuring. One is, the purpose of the Michigan constitutional provision, which was put in place in 1963, was to make pension promises contractual in nature, to give them the status of a contractual obligation of the municipality or the state of Michigan. Prior to 1963, a pension promise was just a gratuity, and gratuity was the term of art, so that Detroit could promise a pension to an employee, the employee could work for 30 years, and then Detroit could change its mind and say, we were just kidding, we're not giving you the pension. The 1963 Michigan constitutional provision was designed to make clear that that is a contractual obligation. It was not designed to say this obligation can never be restructured, even if Detroit runs out of money. So that's one reason I think the pension can be restructured. The other is simply the supremacy clause, which says that in conflict between federal law and state law, even state constitutional law, the federal law prevails. In this case, the federal law is the federal municipal bankruptcy law. Second argument against restructuring pensions in bankruptcy is an argument that allowing a restructuring of pensions in municipal bankruptcy would violate the contracts clause, both of the U.S. Constitution and of the Michigan Constitution. The contracts clause says that a state cannot impair a contractual obligation. The argument would be that bankruptcy is facilitating an impairment by Michigan and by one of its entities, Detroit, of contractual obligations. That's illegal under the contracts clause, again, of the U.S. Constitution and the Michigan Constitution. I don't think this is a silly argument at all. In some respects, I think this is the strongest argument against restructuring, but effectively, it's an argument that the entire municipal bankruptcy framework violates the Constitution, violates the Contracts Clause. If pensions can't be restructured, nearly every other contract can't be restructured either. So this is an argument that municipal bankruptcy is unconstitutional, a position that Detroit's unions have taken in the Detroit case. Where that stands constitutionally is in 1936, the Supreme Court concluded that municipal bankruptcy was unconstitutional on precisely this kind of ground. 2 years later, in 1938, the Supreme Court shifted course and upheld municipal bankruptcy, and that's where we've been ever since. I don't think that the Supreme Court is going to decide that the last 80 years require a do-over and municipal bankruptcy is not constitutional, but it is possible. I do think that's the strongest objection. Final objection is one in municipal bankruptcy law itself. There's a provision in municipal bankruptcy, which is Chapter 9 of the bankruptcy laws, that says that Detroit or another debtor can't do anything that's, quote, prohibited by law. And the argument is restructuring the pensions is prohibited by the Michigan Constitution. In my view, this objection will also fall. That prohibited by law provision seems pretty clearly to kick in after a restructuring has taken place, not to prevent a restructuring. And what it means, I believe, is once Detroit restructures its obligations, nothing about those new obligations can violate Michigan law. Once again, if that provision were construed to say pensions can never be restructured, it would have the same effect on almost any other contract in Detroit as well, and it would effectively gut municipal bankruptcy law. So when you put these objections together, I don't think any one of them will be sustained. I do think that if we get a further review of this issue, if the appeal of the Detroit eligibility decision is ever decided, I think the court is going to conclude pensions can be restructured. Finally, the final issue I wanted to talk about is just the normative implications of this. Is this a good idea? Is this a good thing, or is it a bad thing? In my view, it's actually a good thing for two reasons. One is that some cities seem to me to have pension obligations that are simply insurmountable, that there's really no other way to move forward realistically other than restructuring the obligations in some way. Detroit is obviously the most dramatic example, but it's possible Chicago is going to end up in the same position. So it's valuable to be able to restructure these obligations, at least to some extent, if there's no other alternative. The other benefit is if pensions and other obligations can be restructured in bankruptcy, it will change the way people think about these obligations. There'll be more pressure to make sure that pensions are fully funded, for instance. And I think the overall political implications in the long run would be positive rather than negative from allowing pensions to be restructured. So I've gone on a little bit too long. Why don't I stop there and let Sandy talk a bit and then let you all talk a little bit.
Okay.
Go right ahead, Professor Levin.
Okay, thank you. First of all, let me express my real gratitude for the opportunity to participate in this. I consider Professor Skeel to be a truly significant expert, national expert in this area, and I very definitely am not. I have to say that most of what he says strikes me as extremely sensible, and I just mainly want to offer some observations, and I'll be interested in what he has to say or what any of the people listening in have to say. First of all, with regard to his last comment on the Contracts Clause, one of the interesting features of the Contracts Clause, if one is a textualist, that is, if you really take the text of the Constitution very seriously, then it says that states can't impair the obligation of contracts, period. There is no contracts clause with regard to the powers of the national government. Contracts clause in Article 1, Section 10. And it's one of the most interesting limitations on the states, because I think that one of the realities of the 1787 Constitution, which at times I have to say I think might embarrass at least some members of the Federalist Society, is that the Constitution was drafted by people who really and truly were antagonistic to what states had been doing, particularly with regard to such things as debtor relief. And so the Constitution was written in some very real ways to limit the power of states. And the Contract Clause is one of the really interesting aspects of that. But then you look at Article 1, Section 9, which involves the limitations on the powers of the national government, you don't find anything called the Contracts Clause. And so one might read that as saying, well, what you're really afraid of is state impairment of contracts, that states will be captured by debtors. There are always going to be more debtors than there are creditors, and they'll be particularly responsive to debtors, or in the modern era, to public employees who want generous pensions and who will be able to induce public officials to promise them generous pensions, whether or not they effectively fund them. So that's with regard to contract clause and state government. But what about the national government? I think it's really interesting that one of the assigned powers of Congress, you don't have to infer it, it's there, is the power of Congress to pass a Uniform Bankruptcy Act. And what bankruptcy just does is to impair contracts, or is to allow the impairment of contracts. You've promised to pay a debt, you declare bankruptcy, and lo and behold, you are no longer under an obligation to pay that debt. Now, John Marshall, the one and only time he ever dissented in his entire career in a decision about the meaning of the Constitution, involved a New York bankruptcy law, because he said that states really were without the power to pass any bankruptcy laws at all, whereas the court, I think, properly held that states couldn't pass, in effect, retroactive bankruptcy laws, but they could pass bankruptcy laws that would apply to all future contracts, and you know that's been settled law ever since. So the question, and I think Professor you know, really has identified the right question, is whether the national government can empower states, in effect, to do what they could not do without the authorization of the national bankruptcy laws. And it seems to me that his answer is a pretty persuasive answer, given what it is that bankruptcy does. And if you go the additional route of saying that bankruptcy is not only something that can be useful for individuals to give them a second chance, but also for corporations, including public corporations that we call municipalities or ultimately even that we call states. So that's one comment. The second comment, and something that really, really fascinated me both when I read newspaper articles about Detroit and when I read Professor Skeel's really terrific articles about Detroit, is what my friend and frequent co-author Jack Balkin, who's at the Yale Law School, calls ideological drift. Because I think it's fair to say, though Professor Skeel certainly can correct me, that generally speaking, with regard to personal bankruptcies, liberals like broad bankruptcy provisions and conservatives don't. I, for example, detest the act that Congress passed around 2004 or so that tightened up considerably the ability of individuals to declare bankruptcy. And of course, we've seen some of the consequences of that with regard to home foreclosures, to student debt, and things like that. Whereas, you know, traditionally conservatives, I think, have viewed the possibility of a second chance as moral hazard, rewarding deadbeats, and the like. So a really interesting myth and symbol case in American constitutional law that I love to teach is the Blaisdell case, the Minnesota mortgage moratorium case from 1934. Technically, it's not a bankruptcy case, but it is the most important single contract clause case in our history. And the question is whether the Great Depression allowed homeowners to avoid complying with their contract to pay balloon mortgage payments, which is how mortgages were financed during the Depression. And the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 vote, said, well, in times of emergency, the contract clause really doesn't mean that states can never impair the obligation of contract. Rather, in emergencies, they can. And one of the themes that runs through Professor Skeel's writings, including cases he cites, is that courts have said, well, a number of cities or states are facing real fiscal crises. And in time of fiscal crisis, you have to cut them some slack, including the ability to renegotiate pensions. Now, it's no secret that liberals like myself are very perturbed by what's happening to good, decent, hardworking public employees who had relied on pensions and are discovering, whether in Detroit or Rhode Island or elsewhere, that the retirement income they relied on might not be available. And so politically, my inclination is to say they can't do that. But the paradox here is that there are other circumstances where, of course, I really do support robust bankruptcy provisions that allow renegotiation, that allow second chances. And I think, as I say, one of the things I find interesting in this particular episode is that it's political conservatives who seem to be embracing the rhetoric of Blaisdell, whereas the Cato Institute, in a book on the Dirty Dozen they published a couple of years ago, gave Blaisdell pride of place as the worst decision in our history, precisely because it undid the sanctity of contracts. So I think it's really hard to tell the players without a scorecard politically with regard to the circumstances under which you want to allow entities, whether they're private or ultimately states, to get out of contracts, promises they entered into, and on which people certainly detrimentally relied, as against saying, look, we really are faced with genuine problems, emergency crises, whatever it is you want to call them, and bankruptcy law has always provided a way to renegotiate and reestablish a different baseline from a status quo that is killing us, either as individuals or as a society. There's one other thing I'd like to add, but I'll wait until our conversation because I've gone on too long in terms of my initial response.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Professor Levinson. I'm going to come back to Professor Skeel very briefly, just a minute, to see if he has a response to your remarks. Before we do that, let's open the floor to questions so people can begin queuing. In a moment, we'll hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for our experts today, you'll push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for Professor Skeel or Professor Levinson, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We don't have any questions pending right now. Our lines are open. With that, Professor Skeel, do you want to offer a response to Professor Levinson? Or
I have a couple things I would love to say. Let me start out by saying Professor Levinson had some kind words for me. I am a very small creature in his shadow and have been a big fan of his work for many, many years, and I will be reading Framed. And I hope lots of folks who are on the line will read it as well. The comments were just fabulous. Two things I wanted to note. One is we both spent a lot of time talking about the contracts clause issue. The other big issue in terms of the constitutionality of municipal bankruptcy generally is a state sovereignty issue, whether municipal bankruptcy interferes with state sovereignty. The municipal bankruptcy laws have always tried to get around that by requiring that a state consent before one of its municipalities can file for bankruptcy. Michigan consented to Detroit filing for bankruptcy, which reduces any interference with state sovereignty, but it's not completely clear that that eliminates the problems. My sense of the recent Supreme Court cases, which Professor Levinson knows much, much better than I do, is that one dimension of them is a view of state sovereignty that state sovereignty is not just about the state, it's also about federal-state relations, and to the extent it's meant to protect individuals rather than the state itself, state consent might not be enough to solve any problem. So just to throw the state sovereignty issue out there, I thought I would do that. The other thing I thought I would comment on is the ideological drift idea that Professor Levinson talked about, which I think is an incredibly interesting idea, and there's a lot to it. In the 1930s, conservatives were deeply opposed to the idea of municipal bankruptcy. They said bankruptcy had never been used in this way before. This is an impermissible expansion. Very, very critical of the municipal bankruptcy laws, whereas liberals liked municipal bankruptcy. Now that there's a possibility that pensions will be restructured, the sides have switched a little bit, which does seem a little bit odd, but to give a little bit of comfort to conservatives, I will say that that one difference between the arguments that are being made now in places like Detroit, on the one hand, and cases like Blaisdell, which was a state statute on the other, is the bankruptcy clause is a federal constitutional basis for doing what Detroit will end up doing with its pension. So it's not Michigan suddenly deciding it's going to alter its contracts. We do have a solid constitutional basis, although people can quibble about whether that basis has been taken too far. So let me stop with that. I have one or two other things, but I'll bring them up as the opportunity arises.
Very good. Once again, if you have a question, our lines are completely open. You need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone if you have a question for either of our experts. Professor Levinson, do you have a question or a comment?
Just to follow up on David's last comment, what I think, though, of course, what made Blaisdell so dramatic is that the court, in effect, read in an emergency exception to what appeared to be the very, very clear words of the text. Now, he's right, obviously, that the existence of the Bankruptcy Act provides a kind of cleaner constitutional argument than perhaps Minnesota had in 1934. But one of the things he talks about in his articles is, well, does a state have to, or municipality have to, go the bankruptcy route? Or are there other ways by which it could claim the right to renegotiate, especially unfunded public pensions? And there is a certain perhaps paradox in saying, well, you have to go all the way into bankruptcy if you want to do this, rather than take advantage of other possibilities, because in both cases, whether you call it bankruptcy or whether you call it something else, what's really driving the issue is the perception of a crisis. If this were merely a local blip in municipal or state finance, then the answer would be raise taxes a relatively little bit, or cut some program a relatively little bit, and it'll be resolved. The real problem comes with the magnitude of the figures that David cites, $18 billion, $3 trillion in total, okay. And tax increases or cutting programs won't suffice to solve that problem.
I was just going to mention that we have a couple questions pending. So go ahead with your response.
I will hold off. I was just going to agree with Andy. I won't hold off. I'll just add one sentence, and that is, I think this is Sandy's point about there being effectively an emergency precondition is exactly right. And I think it's a compelling account of the way we treat these cases. And consistent with that, Congress has made it quite difficult for a municipality to file for bankruptcy. The hurdles are much higher. The municipality has to show it's insolvent. It has to show it's tried to negotiate with its creditors, which reinforces this emergency idea.
Does it matter if the emergency is perceived as self-made? In other words, if a municipality or state has spent itself into bankruptcy, does that rise to the level of an emergency?
It's a great question, and I think there would be a little bit of a tension in that, because you can be insolvent. You're insolvent either way, whether it's your fault or whether it's not your fault. But there is a good faith requirement. It's generally thought to focus mostly on whether the city has acted in good faith towards its creditors. But a court could say, you don't belong in bankruptcy because everything you've done reeks of bad faith. You know, you've gambled your resources or whatever. So I think that is relevant, although it has not been on center stage in the municipal bankruptcies that we've had.
All right. Three questions pending now. So with that, if you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our first caller.
Hi, this is Doug Anderson, Chicago. There's been a lot said about municipal bankruptcies, but not so much about state pension obligations, whereas in Illinois we have pretty substantial state pension obligations, as well as the similar constitutional provision saying that they can't be altered. I was wondering what you think about the likely outcome in general for state pension obligations is.
So this is David. I'll jump in on that. And Illinois is really the focus of a lot of the concern about state pension obligations. First of all, as you indicated, there is no state bankruptcy law. A few years ago, in late 2010, early 2011, a number of people, including me, argued that there should be a state bankruptcy law, and Illinois was one of the prime candidates for it. But at this point, there isn't a state bankruptcy law, so that option is not currently on the table. As far as what you can do outside of bankruptcy, it really varies state by state. It depends on what kinds of protections the state has for pensions. As you also indicated, Illinois has a state constitutional protection for pensions that looks to make it very hard to alter existing pension promises. And that's not just benefits that have already accrued, but it's also future benefits to current employees. And Illinois recently passed fairly significant pension reform. There's a real question whether that reform will be upheld or whether it will be struck down as violating the Illinois protection for pensions. So in a state that has strong state constitutional protections for pensions, it's really hard to do anything significant to right the problem. And that's an issue that states like Illinois are facing.
Yeah. Professor Levinson, did you want to weigh in here?
Yeah, just briefly. Several years ago, during the height or the depth of the Great Recession, a lot of people got very, very angry, and I was one of them, when AIG paid very, very handsome bonuses to the people who had run the company into the ground. And at that time, Larry Summers and much more recently Tim Geithner said, but these were contracts and they were lawful contracts and the United States was going to be the position of challenging the sanctity of contract, because if we did that, the whole financial system would collapse. Now, you know, this isn't a session about that, but what I think the relationship is, and this is what makes the ideological drift so interesting, is that in that occasion, it was frankly fat cats who were allowed to take advantage of the sanctity of contracts, and the federal government, run by allegedly liberal Democrats, said, we can't do anything about it. With regard to to Illinois or municipal bankruptcy, now the question is violating contractual promises basically to working stiffs, public employees. And I think in both cases, putting the differences between the AIG and public employees to one side, what we're really talking about at the end of the day, and of course this is at the heart of the whole idea of contracts, is the ability of people to rely on promises at all, and ultimately to trust the state, whether we're talking about it's the state of Illinois or Michigan or the state called the United States of America, that the essence of the social contract is that they're not going to screw you. And now what is called into question is whether you can rely on the state to keep its promises. This is really what's at the heart of the current debate about the Veterans Administration. So I think that putting the law to one side and what the best way of interpreting the Bankruptcy Act is to one side, what we're ultimately talking about is preserving the social contract between the people and their government. And the extent to which at least some of these developments will end up simply increasing the extent of alienation and mistrust in any level of government, local, state, or national.
Can I jump in again?
Go right ahead,
David. This is a really interesting set of comments, and I agree with you, Sandy, completely about the social contract and social expectations issue. I just want to throw out a couple points. One is, I certainly am the last person in the world to defend the AIG bailout and the bailouts of 2008. I'm not a big fan of them. And I agree with you that from a perspective of optics alone, if not even without getting into the other issues, those bonuses shouldn't have been paid. The second point is, when we talk about these issues and preserving the social contract and expectations, It does seem to me pretty complicated. It does seem to me important to consider the whole context and ask the question, what would the cost of protecting the social contract be? And so in Detroit or in Chicago or in Illinois, if you protect those current pensions, that's great, and I think there's an argument for it, but the effect is you're probably going to squeeze out services. You probably are going to cause public employees either to be laid off or not to be hired. This is something Rahm Emanuel has said explicitly in Chicago. He said, if we don't do something about the pensions, the losers are all the people who depend on the city. And so it's a really complicated calculus, but I do agree that the social contract is an important dimension of it.
We've got three questions pending. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, Matthew Christ, a former resident of Detroit, no longer in Detroit, but I have lots of thoughts about the history of Detroit and how we've come to this problem, and I wanted to zoom that back out to comparing the 1930s to the present time, and there has been a lot of changes in Detroit and a lot of changes in the country, but we had earlier a lot of discussion about these emergency considerations and the emergency exception. And I wanted to ask, is that an example of the really terrible circumstances of the 1930s creating a bad precedent? Because in the 1930s, it wasn't an emergency of just one or two municipalities. It could have created a domino effect that could have destroyed many municipalities. And whereas we don't really have that situation today, is there a stark difference between the 1930s creating that precedent and using that precedent today?
So this is David. I'll jump in on that initially as well. I think it's a great question. The 1930s obviously were unique, even as compared to the recent Great Recession. And a lot of the measures that were taken, such as the measure that led to the Blaisdell case and the ultimate affirmation of municipal bankruptcy, were responses to, one of the deepest depressions that we've ever had. Footnote on that situation, back in the 1930s, the areas that were in the biggest trouble in the early 1930s were Detroit. So Detroit figured very prominently in the debates over the original municipal bankruptcy legislation, and Florida, because there had been a real estate boom and bust in Florida. I guess my reaction is that there was a difference in degree in the 1930s, but not a difference in kind. I think that the kinds of issues we face now are not so completely different from the 1930s that 1930s has sent us off down the wrong road. What was done in the 1930s in this area, in the municipal bankruptcy area, actually turned out to be relatively limited, and we have subsequently expanded what we can do with municipal bankruptcy. So I guess I think it's a great question, and certainly in many respects the Great Depression was sui generis, but I don't think it's so radically different from some of the problems that we're seeing now as to make it a dangerous precedent.
Professor Levinson, you want to weigh in here?
No. Everything David said sounds right to me.
Okay. Still two questions pending. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone. This is Hayden O'Byrne in Miami. I just had a quick question, and that is, I wanted to ask about the alternative to bankruptcy. And isn't that just the state ignoring its creditors? And, I understand that a state can't impair contracts, but a state's still a sovereign, and can it just, ignore its creditors, let a judgment be entered, and then, just ignore collection activities? And in that sort of situation, if that's the alternative, then isn't some sort of bankruptcy resolution better for everyone as opposed to just having judgments out there that are unfulfilled?
This is Sandy. I'll be very interested in David's response. And as always, I emphasize he knows much, much more about the law than I do. But one of the things that I think that's fascinating about that question is that it raises another magic word that is certainly much beloved by the Supreme Court these days, which is state sovereignty. And what sovereignty can be interpreted to mean, of course, is exactly what you've just said. Hey, you think I owe you any money? Try to collect it. And so, you know, there are these string of sovereign immunity cases that I detest that the Supreme Court has issued over the last now 20 years that basically deprive people of their right to sue states for things, for wrongs that the state has clearly committed that involve financial damages. In Texas, for example, it's made very clear that there is no right to collect any debt from the state of Texas. It's all a moral obligation, so that a frequent item of legislation in Texas is Texas agreeing to pay a judgment against it for something it's done. But you know, again, I think there's this interesting tension among liberals, conservatives, at different points in time, as to what you really think of the whole idea of state sovereignty in any very strong sense.
This is David. Let me weigh in a little bit. And Sandy's comments, as usual, are incredibly interesting. I didn't know about the situation in Texas. A couple quick points. One is this idea of what is the alternative to bankruptcy was very much at the heart of the argument I made in favor of putting in place a bankruptcy framework for states. And my thinking was you really need to consider what the alternatives are. If you don't have bankruptcy, what's going to happen? One way of looking at it is the state can ignore its creditors. Another way of looking at it is the state, there may just be a catastrophic default. You know, the state just stops paying its bondholders, stops paying its pension beneficiaries. And a question I would want to ask, which I think is similar to yours, is which world are we better off in? A world where we have this bankruptcy option or one where we don't? And it seems to me we're better off in a world where we do have the bankruptcy option. The second comment I'll make is, in addition to or as an alternative to ignoring its creditors, a city or a state, not a city so much, a state could try to pass its own restructuring law or a law that would allow the restructuring of particular kinds of creditors. This is what states did in the 1930s and early 1940s that led to cases like Blaisdell. And in the state context, in the context we've been talking about, there was a case in 1942 called Fay II, where I think it was New Jersey passed a law that allowed its bonds to be restructured, and everybody agreed that the bondholders were more likely to get paid after the restructuring than before the restructuring. This was upheld by the Supreme Court. That option has been taken away by the municipal bankruptcy law. The municipal bankruptcy law has a provision that says state restructuring laws are invalid. And so the scope for states acting to allow a restructuring is in some respects narrower, certainly narrower than it would otherwise have been, which throws us back to your original question, and that is would we be better off in a world where there's no bankruptcy and a state can simply say, sorry, I'm not going to pay? And my view is no, we would not be better off in that world.
Yeah, if I can jump in one final time. David concludes one of his most recent articles with a fascinating discussion of Europe and the various financial crises there. And I'm going to go back to what I said before about of our Constitution in many ways being radically anti-federal or anti-state. One of the most important indices of this is that states are forbidden to have their own currencies. You know, we got the euro 225 years before the Europeans did. And as Paul Krugman and others point out in their skepticism about the euro and the belief that the euro might have been premature, is that if you control your own currency, you can always devalue. And so if the state of Texas or the state of Michigan or the state of Illinois really were a sovereign state with a capital S, it would have its own currency, and it wouldn't need to go bankrupt. It could engage in other measures, which might be quite dubious, but it nonetheless could simply inflate its way out of this financial crisis. The problem, quote unquote, is that states are not sovereign. They're very, very much limited by the national constitution. They're also, of course, part of the national economy. And I think one question, this is a political question, not a legal question, is whether the consequences of a state bankruptcy like Illinois, now we're not talking about South Dakota, but a major state like Illinois, would not have such drastic consequences for the national economy that the national government really would be forced to bail it out. That if GM or AIG are too big to fail, then so is Illinois.
We still have two questions pending, so let's go right to our next caller.
Yes, it's David Emerson in Berkeley, California. The question is, when fashioning a remedy for restructuring underfunded pensions, in looking at what got us into the condition where we are today, there seems to me what I'd call kind of an axis of evil between the government unions, politicians, and those who set the compensation for their employees, and resulting in some cases, very generous pay and benefit packages for state and municipal employees, many of which are far in excess of what would be offered in the private sector. You know, examples of pension spiking and particularly egregious police and fire pensions. So my question has to do with, when fashioning this remedy, do either of the speakers have any thoughts on how approach that would be different than a pro rata haircut, a pro rata reduction, which would affect the most outrageous pensions and the most modest pensions equally, but instead, do you have any thoughts about an approach which would impose more of a cap or a haircut on the really excessive pensions while allowing a very modest, let's say, administrative worker to retain the greater benefit of their pension benefits?
This is Sandy. I'll just jump in that briefly and, again, just underscore the politics of it, that I would be sympathetic to the drift of your question if at the same time we had ways of going after the access of evil called corporate compensation committees that give what I regard as totally outrageous salaries to lots and lots of corporate executives. Because I think the point you're making is that one of the great pleasures in life is spending other people's money or making promises to spend other people's money and not really being accountable. But I think this occurs throughout our economy and not only with regard to public employees and pensions.
So this is David. A couple things, both on the question and on Sandy's response. I do think that there are fairness issues in different places, and there are some fairness issues in corporate compensation, and it's worth looking at those as people are at this point. So I have a lot of sympathy for that general point. It is the case, in my view, that the bargaining over public pensions has been very unusual bargaining, where rather than having two different sides to the bargaining, both sides were on the same side of the table. The public employees wanted big pensions, and big pensions were attractive to the state lawmakers who were granting them as well, because often the state lawmakers had the same pensions. They depended on the votes of the people who were getting pensions. And if you make a pension promise that you don't have to pay today, you can pay 20 or 30 years from now. It also doesn't hurt your budget. And it turns out that pension obligations in, I think, every state are not subject to the balanced budget requirement. So lots of problems with the bargaining process, in my view. In terms of whether you can take particular problems into account in your restructuring, maybe not as much as you might want to, but I think there are some things you can take into account, and we're actually seeing some evidence of this in Detroit. I don't know what the final outcome will be, but one thing that you're seeing is a move to have a minimum pension benefit, so that there'll be a minimum amount that's protected, even if strictly speaking, you shouldn't be entitled to that from a prorated kind of perspective. So minimums are one way to promote fairness. Another way is to invalidate or make adjustments for things that are clearly egregious. And one example of that in Detroit is Detroit had a policy over the last 10 or 20 years of, in good years, issuing what it called 13th checks, where it would simply give people a bonus if the pension fund assets had done well in that year, which is just egregious management of the pensions in every conceivable way, assuming that that you can pay people extra in good years and you don't have to take anything back in bad years. Detroit is moving to take account of those 13th checks, in my understanding is they're trying to do something about it, so that if you got some of those extra checks, your payout might be reduced to reflect that. And I think that's a good thing. I think these fairness issues, both in the pension context and in other contexts as well, are very, very important issues. And when the process is not perceived as fair, as the 2008 bailouts were not perceived as fair, there are real consequences from that.
We've got two callers with questions remaining. Let's see if we can get at least this next one in.
Hi, the question I had, and I apologize for coming in late, but it's a very fascinating discussion, and I thank both of the professors for being with us. But the pension benefits are not, you said the pension benefits are not subject to the balanced budget amendment in all states, but for example, in New York City, they are, and that's what's made New York City so successful after the crisis that they went through, because they have actually subjected pension benefits to gap accounting. And so the question I would have, to David's point, which world are we better off in? I would think we're better off in a world where you have rules. When you write a contract, you know what the contract says. With respect to AIG, there was no bankruptcy, so the contracts were still valid. With respect to GM, we had no idea what the law was because it was hammered together at a union table, and the bondholders were harmed. With respect to Fannie and Freddie, well, those cases are still being moved to the courts, but it seems like those are a lawless situation as well. And the rules were really clear, I think, when Alexander Hamilton decided that he was going to take over the state debt. But then it was also clear in the 1840s when the U.S. government said they would not take over the state debts, and nine states defaulted. Those are very clear. The rules are also clear with respect to Argentina right now in the cases that are wending to the Second Circuit. And so my question, I guess, is, and I'm sorry for the moving all over the place here, but what world are we better off in? Aren't we better off with a world that's the rule of law rather than one that's trying to look at fairness or politics to make a decision as to what the rules are going to be? And isn't that what the bankruptcy law is all about?
This is David. I'll jump in quickly. You've raised nearly every big financial case of the last few years, and each one of them would be worth talking about in great detail. I'm very sympathetic to your point about the rule of law. I think the rule of law is very important, and there were a few junctures in 2008 and in 2009 where I think the rule of law was abused. I think it was abused in Chrysler, more Chrysler than GM. I also think it's been abused in Fannie and Freddie. But with a lot of these issues, there also are decisions that the government makes on whether to intervene or not intervene that you can be doing consistent with the rule of law. And the question is, when do you intervene and when do you not intervene? And my general fairness point there would be that the interventions need to be perceived. It's important that they be perceived as fair. And I think in 2008, many people in the country, rightly in my view, felt that Wall Street was bailed out and Main Street wasn't bailed out. And I think there are consequences to that, even if what the government is doing is not strictly speaking violating the rule of law.
Let me ask both our professors if they have just a minute or two to take a final question.
Sure.
Sure.
Okay. Let's do take this last question then.
Real quickly, Ted Arujo from Syracuse, New York. I'm a bankruptcy attorney. I taught economics for 10 years. I think the sovereign immunity issue on the states in bankruptcy has been answered by a 2006 case, Katz versus Community Commonwealth of Virginia. And
right.
The Supreme Court basically said no 11th Amendment immunity. Why we're getting into public versus private decisions here, I'm not sure. But one thing to keep in mind about the Great Depression, or two things, the federal government made up about 1% of spending, and there were no municipal unions in the United States. So these unions, and the gentleman from California makes the point, you can't get elected in California unless a statewide office unless you go to the corrections officers union and get their permission. So each one of these municipal agreements, especially in New York, where I'm from, that rented into with respect to benefits, was projected that it would bankrupt the state when 20 or 30 years passed. So these were contracts of adhesion. We are basically saying to retirees, now, when you were 30 and 40, you forced these contracts on people so they could get your support. Now you're whining and moaning that you can't get paid, even though at the time, the comptrollers, economists, et cetera, said, there's no way we're going to be able to pay these benefits. So with respect to the social contract with the public sector unions, which were illegal until 1967 and 68 in California and New York, I, as a taxpayer, don't feel any obligation to them. And I would say one thing. I filed thousands of bankruptcies. I've never seen a municipality, a bank, or a home destroyed because the person who owned the debt filed bankruptcy. It just shifts who's going to get paid. Thank you.
Responses?
Sandy, do you want to jump in?
There's not enough time to give the question the full kind of discussion it deserves. But I think that, once again, there are competing political narratives. One of them is what we've just heard, that I certainly think rests on some aspect of the truth, that is the rise in the power of public employee unions in the last half century or so, the fact, and this is what terrified Alexander Hamilton. You have to recall in the 78th Federalist, his principal defense of a strong judiciary is that it would protect the discrete and insular minority of the well-off from the majority of those who are less well-off, who would use the power, basically, of the ballot in order to pass debtor relief legislation and other redistributive legislation. And we've been wrestling with that issue ever since. The left-wing narrative, as it were, is that if you look at the political system, you discover that it's for sale to those who have the most money. So that Larry Lessig, for example, talks about the money primary. You don't get to the ballot these days unless you can put together gazillions of dollars raised from gazillionaires. So you have, I think, two competing narratives for what is, I personally believe, a genuine crisis in our governing order. I think we heard one eloquent question that really did express the loss of any real belief in the validity of the social contract because of the way the contracts were entered. And I, as I say, I think there are conservative versions of that loss of faith, and there are more leftish versions of the loss of faith, and that both of them come together to create the present reality of a 10% public approval rate of Congress.
A final thought, perhaps, from Professor Skeel.
I'll just say something very quickly. I do think that this question and Sandy's answer really put their finger on a huge issue in this area. And one way just to reinforce the idea is in the 1930s, municipalities were much, much less complicated. They did much less than they do now. The issue in the 1930s was really bond debt and nothing else. Since then, we have had the growth of public pensions. We've had cities providing other kinds of services. So this is a very complicated situation. And I guess my final line on it is, I believe bankruptcy is the best device we have available for trying to sort it out.
Well, this is Dean Reuter once again. I want to thank both of our experts, Professor Skeel and Professor Levinson. He's also, I'll repeat, the author of the book Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. I encourage you to take a look at that. But again, my thanks to both of you for your thoughts and your time today. Also to the audience, I want to thank you for dialing in and for your thoughtful questions and your attention. And a reminder to check the Federalist Society's website for upcoming teleforum conference calls. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.